The housing market steps down yet again.
And consumers are feeling a little blue.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org. It is Tuesday, December 28th. Home prices fell in October for the fourth straight month, down about 0.6%, more than economists expected. Analyst Julie Neiman joins me now from Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis, as she does every Tuesday. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Jeremy.
So I'm looking at the numbers here from the closely watched Case-Shiller Index of Home Values. It came out earlier this hour. In October, Julie, prices dropped 2.9% in Atlanta. That was the worst of the 20 cities in the survey. 2% drop in Chicago, down a little more than 1% in Seattle. In fact, all 20 cities are down. Now, am I crazy, Julie, or is there a pattern going on here?
Well, today's data basically just reinforces the further price declines we're seeing. That conforms to the 10% decline that Case-Shiller is really anticipating. And it's pointing to the fact that there are a lot of green shoots, hopefully, in the building industry, but everybody's just grasping at straws. The inventory overhang is the big problem, the Sand States, Nevada, California, Florida, Arizona.
Right.
And foreclosures. And mortgages aren't easy to get. Rates are climbing and standards are tightening.
But consumers, Julie, are supposedly getting more confident. We're getting some positive numbers in various other sectors of the economy. Why is the housing market living in a world of its own?
Well, it's really a difference between short-term and long-term. Short-term, there's a little more job stability, savings rate is up a little bit, consumers are paying down their debt, so there are a few extra coins in the jeans here.
Right.
And if they shop, retailers have a 50% red tag, give it to me free sale, so we shop. If we go out to dinner, it's Groupon or restaurants.com, so there's a little bit more spending going on there. But long-term commitments like marriages and mortgages, no way.
You have any coins in the jeans right now, Julie?
$1.380. I always carry
it. Okay. Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company, thanks so much.
You bet.
It was a good holiday season for retailers, and word on the street was the consumer was back. But consumer confidence dropped this month, according to the Conference Board, and it's been hurt by worries about the job market. Mitchell Hartman has more.
What had been a steady improvement in consumer confidence since midsummer lost momentum in December, according to the Conference Board, and sentiment's still hovering at levels more associated with a recession than a recovery. But the signals have been mixed. Another measure of consumer attitudes, out earlier this month from the University of Michigan, was more upbeat. And retail sales through the holidays have been blockbuster, up anywhere from 4% to more than 5%. Bernard Baumol is with the Economic Outlook Group.
Fact is that Americans have been spending now during the holiday shopping season at a pace that we haven't seen in about half a decade. And I think generally the mood is higher.
One thing that could dampen that mood, though, says Baumol, if gas prices shoot much higher. He says at $3.50 or $4 a gallon, consumers and businesses will start cutting back on other spending. And that could make them more apprehensive about the economic future. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, December 28th. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Now to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world?
There's a new plan in the news this morning that would force banks to reveal how big banker bonuses are and why. Our own Stephen Beard joins us now to talk about this. Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, Stacey.
Stephen, we've heard all sorts of plans to rein in bank bonuses. Where's this one coming from?
Well, yes, that's right. We've had British and European regulations. This plan is part of the so-called Basel III set of planned banking regulations. If adopted, these will affect all of the big banking countries that have signed up to it, including the US.
Hmm. What's different about this approach?
Well, this aims to use disclosure to bring some discipline to the payment of bonuses. So it'll mean that banks have to name which bankers are getting how much and what they've done to earn it. So this isn't bureaucrats restricting bonuses. This leaves it to the market, to the bank's shareholders, for example, to judge whether the bonuses are reasonable. And it leaves it to the markets generally to judge which banks have the most prudent bonus policies.
Will that disclosure, is the thought that that disclosure would cut the size of the big bonuses bankers are getting?
are not, according to a British banking expert, Ralph Silver, that I've been talking to. He thinks it may now be easier for the top performing investment bankers to collect big bonuses.
If you actually see in a report card that a banker brought in $100 million and he gets a $5 million bonus, all of a sudden, this seems like it's reasonable, the amount of money. In other words, if you sell more shoes in a shoe store and you make more money because you're on commission, that's okay.
He says the bankers who aren't bringing in more business and those who are actually losing money will suffer. They'll probably lose their bonuses under this plan.
Stephen Beard in London. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, Stacey.
This is the biggest giving time of the year, and so far, estimates are charity donations will be down 10% in 2010. But the drop isn't being seen online. As Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports, social media is generating new, easy ways to give.
Katja Andreessen is with a company that manages donations to charities online. She says the two biggest giving days of the year are the last 2 days of the year.
A lot of generous procrastinators wait till then to make their gifts. That is perfectly suited to the online medium and a great time for nonprofits to really invest in online outreach.
And they are. Causes.com manages campaigns for thousands of nonprofits on Facebook. And this year, it launched a feature that allows you to fundraise for your favorite charity by getting your friends to donate to it instead of buying you a holiday gift.
It's actually a lot easier than like going to the store and picking something out.
Co-founder Joe Green says this and similar campaigns have generated $9 million, and much of that is coming from unexpected sources.
Charities tell us that the donors we bring them are donors they didn't have before.
And here's a tip for those new donors. If you get your donation in by the end of the year, you can take a deduction on this year's taxes. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, December 28th. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. Alabama got $55 million from the Obama administration this week to make it easier for kids to sign up for insurance under Medicaid. 14 other states got smaller awards. You could call it sort of an anti-bureaucracy bribe, as Gregory Warner reports from the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia.
Here's an example of bureaucracy at work. You cannot renew Medicaid for all your kids on the same day. This in many states. You have to bring in each kid on the anniversary of the day he enrolled, usually his birthday. Parents miss that deadline, their kid gets dropped from coverage. Happy birthday.
This is not only a burden for the family, it's an insane burden for the agency, which simply has to redo its work over and over again.
Helen Newborn is with the Ford Foundation. It's funding a demonstration project to help states simplify enrollment. She says some states prefer to keep it complicated.
Knowing that what happens is that families simply can't get through the paperwork and therefore they lose the benefit. And that becomes a way for a state to, in a sort of a backdoor way, reduce the number of people claiming state funds.
To win the federal grant, Alabama ended the bring-in-each-kid-on-their-birthday rule. It also made forms you can sign electronically. Similar changes could be in store for your state. The health care reform law mandates streamlined enrollment nationwide by 2014. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Missouri faces Iowa tonight at the Insight Bowl in Arizona.
Okay, Jeremy, who are you rooting for?
Well, I'm from Illinois, so I'm going to stay out of that matchup, Stacey. But those two public universities pay their head coaches millions of dollars each, and they're not alone. Even as state schools face monumental budget challenges, they're actually boosting sports salaries. Gigi Duban has that story from Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Crystal Bishop is cashing out her drawer at the 15th Street Diner in Tuscaloosa. This is home of the University of Alabama's Crimson Tide football team. Bishop is baffled that head football coach Nick Saban earns $5 million a year.
I think that's entirely too much. All that he do is write X and O's on a chart and get paid $5 million.
So it's not quite that simple. Even Bishop agrees that Saban put Tuscaloosa back on the map.
I guess without the UA, Tuscaloosa would be nothing.
This is how college officials make the case for why some coaches are easily worth millions of dollars a year. Mal Moore is athletics director at the University of Alabama. He says when Saban took Alabama to a 2009 national championship, fundraising at the university shot up.
even with the down economy, the royalties that came to the university, I think, was very strong.
Royalties from sales of Crimson Tide jerseys, oven mitts, even garden gnomes. Now, of Sabin's $5 million salary, the university pays $245,000. The rest comes from things like fundraising groups, endorsements, speaking fees. And, Moore points out, the athletics department pays for itself. One way it does that?
Faithful fans that buy their tickets come to the games year in and year out.
But that's changing. The Associated Press reports that some schools are having a hard time filling seats for upcoming bowl games. And with a down economy and public university budgets hurting, athletic departments have less money to play with. So universities are increasingly subsidizing sports programs, says Doug Letterman. He's the editor of Inside Higher Ed.
And at that point, the argument about how much is being spent on the athletic programs themselves starts to change a little bit, because it is more clearly university money and money that could be going to the library or could be going to faculty salaries.
But unlike professors, there's no tenure track for a coach. One or two losing seasons, and that high-priced coach is out the door. In Tuscaloosa, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
If you've been on your smartphone lately, trying to rebook plane tickets perhaps, you've been using rare earth metals. Those are obscure materials used in devices like cell phones and hybrid cars. China controls 97% of global supplies, and they're cutting exports back more than 10% next year. So another country is stepping in to help meet demand. Christopher Worth has more.
Rare earths are not so rare. There are other sources of them outside China, like Australia and the U.S. But Stuart Burns, who tracks metals markets for the website Metal Miner, says it's not just about mining raw rare earths. It's also what you do once you get them out of the ground.
It's refining it into oxides and metals that can be used.
With China cutting exports, the lack of refining facilities in other parts of the world is causing much concern. And it's why this factory for refining rare earths in northeast Estonia, one of the few remaining outside China, could have a bright future, not just a long history.
It's been working like this for almost 40 years.
David O'Brock is the CEO of Silmet, the company that owns and operates the plant, and he's showing me around.
Please watch your head here.
This facility was originally built under Stalin to enrich uranium at the start of the Cold War. Today, workers are instead busy churning out around 2 to 3% of the world's supply of processed rare earths, about 3,000 tons a year, although O'Brock would like to produce more.
Demand for our products has increased a lot.
About 10 years ago, China began flooding the market with its own cheap rare earth supplies. As prices dropped, other refineries folded.
It was completely the best way to lose money at that time.
Now, China has turned off the spigot, and rare earth prices have jumped. Here at Silmet, the price fetched for the rare earth neodymium used in products like cell phones has gone from $15 a kilogram to around $85 over the past year. O'Brock says there's just one problem.
Our bottleneck has always been the raw material, not being able to get enough as what our market needs, and it continues to be today.
But with prices rising, O'Brock says he's hopeful new mines currently getting underway in the U.S. and elsewhere will soon step in to meet the booming demand. In Estonia, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
If you think we're getting more and more superficial and materialistic these days, Stacey, here is a reality check from the U.K.
Okay,
a 16th century book telling doctors how to perform nose jobs was just sold at auction there.
Are leeches involved in this?
I'm not sure, but you know, it was actually sold to a modern day plastic surgeon, and I'm just hoping that he doesn't actually use it, you know, to figure out how to...
like a vintage nose job.
Yeah, that's right. I'm going for an old look. There is no word, though, Stacey, on whether that book came with a ye olde videotape on the ancient reality show Real Housewives of Stratford-upon-Avon.
Who's churning the butter tonight?
I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.